You're heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 91, covering the week of September 25th through September 29th, 2017. Glad to have you back in the program. Glad to be here. Before we get started, just want to remind you of several things. If you do like this podcast, please share it around on social media. And you can find us on social media. You can find us on Facebook. Just look for Abbeville Institute. Also on Twitter, at Abbeville INST. And also on YouTube, just look for Abbeville Institute. You can subscribe to us there. Also, if you want to skip trying to search for all those things, just go to our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org. At the top of the page, you have all of our social media buttons, and you have our Amazon Smile button. So every time you shop at Amazon, you'll give us a few pennies when you purchase something if you go through our Amazon Smile account. Also, if you go to our webpage and give us an email address, we will give you a free ebook, Kirkpatrick Sales Emancipation Hell. So go ahead and pick that up, and you get our daily dose of Dixie Monday through Friday and our weekly email on Saturday or Sunday. So go ahead and pick that up. And do remember that we do exist on your generous contributions alone. So if you do want to support the Abbeville Institute's mission to explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition, please consider making a tax-deductible contribution to the Abbeville Institute. You can donate monthly or annually. If you are a student, you can donate as little as $3 a month or $25 a year. If you are not a student, it's $5 a month or $50 a year. So that's the lowest amount you can donate, but it will help us keep the lights on, help keep the podcast going, help keep the website running, and help keep us providing high-quality programs. So all of those things are out there for you. Remember, our website is a virtual Library of Southern Thought. So all kinds of things. Your donation would help keep that going, help keep the lectures up there for free. All the things that we offer, over 1,000 articles, hundreds of lectures, free audio lectures, the Jim McClellan Library, which is primary source material. So there's so much stuff out there that it's just would take you weeks to go through it all. Okay, let's talk about the material this week. A lot of good stuff, I think. And generally on a theme, the theme would be the misinterpretation of Southern history, and I think that's, or I should say, misinterpretation of American history by various individuals. And so when you start on Monday, we had a piece by Vito Musumeli entitled American Sovereignty and Unconditional Loyalty. And what I like about this piece is it gets into a very interesting topic, and that is the religious zeal of union. So oftentimes, and you see this even today, people will tell you that secession is treason, that the secessionists in 1861, Southerners, were committing treason by leaving the Union, that the Union is somehow sacrosanct, that it is ordained by God that we are going to have this union, and that going against the union is going against God. Now, these are the kind of arguments that were actually used in the royal absolutism period of European history. You know, when you have people like Louis XIV, the divine right of kings, the king was the state. And so to oppose the king was to oppose God, because obviously there was no accidental birth, and so as Louis was born to be king, to oppose Louis would be to oppose the will of God. And in this particular case, when you look at the Union, if you look at the Constitution as a religious document, meaning that it was God-breathed, it was divinely inspired to have this type of document, then there can be no opposition to it. In fact, what will happen during the war, as Mr. Musumeli points out, is you would have religious figures start making the case that this was a holy crusade, that saving the Union became a holy crusade. And it takes on this religious zeal. And you had various individuals doing this. But there were people who were against this type of activity. In fact, James Buchanan called it a disease of the public mind, and Thomas Fleming, not the Thomas Fleming from Chronicles or Rockford, but Thomas Fleming the historian, the popular historian, wrote a book entitled that before he died, A Disease of the Public Mind, which is very good, because he actually points out that abolitionists, the radical abolitionists of the North, were pushing an agenda that most Americans were against. It wasn't just slavery, it was the way they were portraying the institution of slavery, or the way they were portraying Southerners more importantly. It was creating a political climate that was hostile. You couldn't have any reconciliation when you're calling Southerners vomit, when you're calling Southerners essentially beasts. There's going to be no reconciliation in that. There's no dialogue. And this is where we've gotten to today, but I think in some ways worse. I just received a copy of Chronicles Magazine, and the title on the cover is Two Americas. I think what we're getting to in America are incompatible things again. We're seeing it with all the football protests and the reaction to the football protests. I mean, all these things. We're having a real culture war in the United States now. A culture war we have not seen since the 1850s in America. Even during the turbulent 20th century at times when it seemed like there was a culture war, there really wasn't, because people had general fundamental beliefs that were similar. But I think we've gotten to a point now we just don't have that anymore. And those who are against what the left is trying to do, culture in America, are called all kinds of terrible names. It doesn't matter if you're not those things or not. It doesn't matter at all, because you're opposed to their agenda, and so therefore you are vomit. You're the worst dirt on the bottom of their shoe. And of course, they're going to call you all kinds of other things. One of the things they often throw around is the term fascist, which has no meaning because they don't know what it means. And of course, we've already talked about that, how Lee would have opposed the Nazis. Of course he would have. Lee would have fought Nazis. He wasn't a Nazi. And so when you look at this culture war brewing, though, there's two sides, and these two sides really can't see eye to eye on a whole lot of things. We can debate positions, but once you get to the point where you just start calling each side names, and of course, you know, the other side, the left, is being called all kinds of names too. When you get to that point, there's no reconciliation. And so this is what was going on in the 1850s. But Vito is taking this into a political side. And he says this, quote, "The same disorienting disease produced the unconditional loyalty of the Republican reverends, Republican generals, and the first Republican administration, with its own newspapers preaching about the glory benefiting a generation that can die for their government. Sherman became the living poster boy for such loyalty and its violence. The realm of government was their realm. If a citizen accepted the sovereignty of the national government before all others, Sherman, Lincoln, Bellows, etc., were with you to death. If you were folks north to south, east to west, who moved to your own hearts and intellects and did not honor unconditional loyalty to the national government, they saw no obstacle to killing you." And this is true. So, when you look at this unconditional loyalty, that idea was essentially foisted on America during the war. Not before that. I mean, you'd have people like, you know, Stephen Decatur saying, "My country, right or wrong, but my country first and foremost." But that kind of patriotism was different. This is, as Vito points out, you either accept national sovereignty, and this is where we get to this idea of sovereignty. Can sovereignty be divided? Is there such a thing? Is there a divided sovereignty between the center and the states? And that's a philosophical and philosophical question. But the question is, the point became, now that there's national sovereignty, to oppose it is to oppose God. And this is how the religious leaders, as he points out at the beginning of the piece, portrayed it. These people are devils. Reverend Beecher in the North said that conservatives are devils. He physically said that. I mean, he actually said it. Conservatives are devils. Where are we hearing this now? I remember back a few years ago, the left tried to say that Jesus was a liberal and Pontius Pilate was a conservative, a devil, essentially. So this type of rhetoric is now being used again. It hasn't gone anywhere. It's still around us. It's still the Republican Party legacy. This, as Buchanan called it, a disease of the public mind. Now, Thomas Fleming was just excoriated for writing that book. But he's looking at it and saying, you know, we've got two sides here that aren't conversing. They aren't communicating. We've got one side that's classifying the other side as devils. Well, where are you going to go with that? There's no communication then. And that's what Vito is pointing out in this particular piece. So it's very good. It's a longer piece, but it's excellent reading because he does outline how that religious zeal transferred into this crusade of war in 1861. So again, this is a different view of history. It's one that was actually accepted for years, that there was blame to be had on all sides when leading to the war. And then, of course, when you get to the 1950s into the 60s, that trend tends to start changing a little bit with people like Kenneth Stamp. And then, of course, it all became the Southern secessionists that led the American people into war. There was fault only on their side, and you just had these righteous Northerners who were just doing all they could to prevent the war, and gosh darn it, they just had to go to war. This is the treasury of counterfeit virtue that is so awful in the American historical profession and in America at large, as we're going to see. This is again, as I said, misinterpretation of American history in various ways. All right, so we have this. Then on Tuesday, I ran a book review by yours truly on Philip Lee's excellent book, Southern Reconstruction. And again, here you have the same type of narrative. Reconstruction it was a good time. This is the Eric Foner thesis, the unfinished revolution. That wasn't a tragic era. Not at all. In fact, if it was an unfinished revolution that needs to be continued. And Lee actually takes seriously the impact of Reconstruction on both white and black Southerners. It wasn't an unfinished revolution to him. It was a tragic period again, a tragic episode, and one that lasted far beyond the arbitrary end date of 1877. And see, by saying it's an unfinished revolution, you cut it off at 1877 and say, well, everything after that was just bad because we stopped real progress in America. Of course, you got to remember, Eric Foner is a card-carrying communist. That's what he is. And so to say it's an unfinished revolution is to suggest that this vanguard, this neo-Marxist vanguard, needs to go forward, and that Reconstruction was somehow a neo-Marxist revolution. But what Lee says is no. I mean, this was what happened is the South was punished, as the Kennedys' the Kennedy brothers' title of one of their books was Shotwell Press. They were punished with poverty. All Southerners were. The South was devastated by the war, physically, socially, economically, politically. And the war, though, didn't just affect the South, even though the title of the book is Southern Reconstruction. It also affected the North. Because the crony capitalism of the Republican Party is going to stuff pockets, northern pockets, full of southern cash, essentially, through subsidies and pensions. So when people say the South wasn't punished enough, he says, oh my gosh, they're paying Union soldiers pensions who killed them. That's reparations. It's exactly what it is. Some people will say, well, Southerners need to pay reparations for this. They already have, he said. They paid pensions for years. The people that were physically involved in the war kept paying pensions, and they were paying higher taxes. And if you look at Southern monuments, as we pointed out on this podcast before, they're paying to build those things. They're paying to build Northern monuments, but not Southern ones. The general government wasn't paying to build Southern monuments. Southerners were paying out of their own pocket for that, while they're also paying to build Northern monuments. So Southerners were paying reparations. And I think it's in this way that Lee's book is so good. It's like the Dunning School, but Lee is very fair in treating, of course, some of the problems of Reconstruction, some of the racial problems of Reconstruction. He's not pro-South, or he's not pro-racial violence. He calls out Southerners for doing things that were not above the board. And so this is a very even-handed book, a look at the wrongs of both North and South in Reconstruction. But more importantly, as he says at the end of the book, this is a wonderful quote. He says, quote, just as the hippie and intellectual elites who dominated public opinion during the Vietnam War, while they disparage American soldiers, have fallen into obscurity, so also might those portraying Reconstruction as a South as evil twin story might eventually fade in the face of the larger national narrative. If so, countervailing accounts like the one in this book must be told, shared, and expanded. And his point was, look, we wouldn't have all the terrible things going on in the political and social climate today if we actually just told the real story about the war and Reconstruction. Because all we're doing is creating division. If we really told the story how blacks were used as pawns in the South, one of his best chapters is on racial reconciliation. And how he points out that blacks were being used as political pawns. And some recognized it. People like Hiram Rose Revels recognized it. But of course, that's not a story that's told. Booker T. Washington's South is not told. His story is not told. What we get is Eric Foner's story of Reconstruction. Our story lacks depth and complexity, the modern story. But Lee has returned that story, I think, to a better center in looking at things objectively, North and South, right and wrong, both regions, and how Reconstruction affected everything in America, not just the South. And even though, again, the title is Southern Reconstruction, he's looking at it in the long durée, what's called the long durée, the long view. And I think he takes seriously the position that Southerners were being abused by these Reconstruction governments. And he says they were. And the Southerners were being abused by the central government. They were. And so that will actually get into the last piece of the week. But again, this is a narrative that's often not told anymore because it's not politically correct to say these things. But in so many ways, it would be a better story because you would actually have people that were interested in reconciliation. Hey, you know, this thing affected everybody. There were bad guys on both sides. There was no righteous cause here. There was no unfinished revolution. There was no revolution at all. Let's not get into the neo-Marxist vanguard story. Let's stop inviting Eric Foner to go speak before Civil War groups or universities. I just saw that Foner was invited to speak at the University of the South. I mean, how disgusting. The left should use Foner because he's one of them, but you have quote-unquote conservatives talking about how brilliant Eric Foner is. Eric Foner is one of the most divisive historians ever to write a page in American history. And he shouldn't be so celebrated. In my estimation, he wrote one good book, Free Soil, Free Labor, Free Men. That's it. Everything else is Marxism. Even that book has got it in it, but at least he's taking seriously this position that, you know, Northerners were as complicit in some of the problems as Southerners, and so are some of the issues as Southerners. So I think in that way it's a valuable book, pointing out the hypocrisy. One of the reasons why Northerners wanted to keep Southerners out of the Western territories is because they didn't want the competition of slave labor. They were just as racist as the South. So in that way, we have a different story of Reconstruction and the war. And how that story is portrayed in our popular media has also changed. As Clyde Wilson points out in Wednesday's piece, Hollywood Before the Hate Confederate Movement. And he lists all these actors and actresses who were more than willing to play sympathetic Southerners. either Confederates or people that were good Southerners. I mean, it's a long list, even into the 1990s. And I always point out one of the great movies of the 1990s came out in 1999, Ride with the Devil. And there are several people in Ride with the Devil who are sympathetic Southerners. One he didn't point out was Jim Caviezel. Now, he's not in the list, and I meant to ask him about that. But Jim Caviezel was just run through the mud because he played Jesus in The Passion of the Christ, which is the Mel Gibson movie. But he was also in Ride with the Devil. Jim Caviezel had a hit TV show recently, Person of Interest, which is very anti-government, very anti-surveillance state. Which is really interesting. But here he is in that movie, Ride with the Devil. But Tobey Maguire, who later became Spider-Man, was in this. And Jewel, the famous singer. And so you've got several actors in that. But, I mean, all down the line from, you know, the 1950s forward, you had people, and people you wouldn't think were portraying Southerners in a sympathetic light, particularly in movies like Gods and Generals, or Gettysburg, Martin Sheen, for example. Martin Sheen played sympathetic Southerners or Confederates several times. So, it's interesting. But again, this is at a time when the popular portrayal of the Confederacy in the South was different than it is now. You know, Dennis Quaid playing a sympathetic Southerner. Michael Douglas. These are people that are, of course, popular actors today, or at least, you know, back in the 80s and 90s. You're not going to find a portrayal of a Southerner that's as good as it used to be. Now they're always the serial killers. They're always the evil people. Southerners are always the bad guys. They're always the hayseeds, the stupid people. I even think back to Saving Private Ryan, and one of the psychotic character was a Southerner, the sniper. He's a Southerner. Just a strange cat in the group. But it wasn't always that way. But that's what you're going to get now. The Southerner is always the strange guy. But, of course, you did have Hell on Wheels, which was the AMC show, where you had the character Cullen Bohannon as a sympathetic character, Southerner. And the interesting thing about that, the enemy, the evil guy, was a Union soldier. And the Swede, they called him. So you had that. But that's rare to have that kind of portrayal. And as we're going to see coming up, you're going to have some HBO and Amazon are going to release kind of dystopian series where the Confederacy is portrayed, I'm sure, negatively, and Southerners are portrayed negatively in that particular, in those series. So we'll see what happens there. But again, this is popular portrayal of Southerners and in film, and how that's changed over time, how the narrative has changed from the 1950s to today. Also, when it comes to people like Andrew Jackson, we have Dade Benner write a really nice piece on Tour at the Hermitage. So this is something I wish we would do more of. Go to a historic site, have somebody write about it, and then we put it on the website, you know, what the interpretation is like there, how that really meshes with real history. And he does a nice job of this. He starts by expressing that, you know, Jackson's not one of his favorite people, and nor mine. I think I've always said Jackson is an American hero because of his military exploits, but not as president. That's something we have to separate the two. You know, Jackson is the hero of New Orleans. Jackson was the hero of the Creek War, we can't take that away from him. And he was a very good general officer. But not a very good president, and so because of his abuse of power. But he talks about how the video that you get at the beginning has people like John Meacham and Annette Gordon-Reed. Of course, you're going to get those. I mean, these are the quote unquote stars now, the historical stars, and both have their own problems. But He points out that the video you get when you come in has several fallacies. The video contends, he says, that the Democratic Party wasn't an actual political party. It was, quote, an embodiment of the people. But, of course, the Democratic Party was a political party. It was a well-oiled machine that was created by Martin Van Buren to get Jackson elected and create a top-down approach to American politics. That the parties are ruining things in America today. If you're an R or a D, you can't go beyond that very narrow vision of what's best for America. If the R's do it, you're good with it. If the D's do it, you're not, and vice versa. This is the problem with parties. And he also says that the idea that the video portrays is that Jackson, quote, peacefully settled the nullification crisis, which he says simply wasn't true. Nullification actually worked, and Jackson was, of course, willing to send in the troops and engage in violence to collect the tariff in South Carolina. And the video also says that secession and nullification are the same thing, which of course they're not. Nullification, the idea of nullification is to avoid secession, to kind of a halfway between secession and just blind obedience. When the government is passing unconstitutional legislation, you got to do something about it. So that was the way nullification was always portrayed in that particular way. So he does point out accurately that the nullification and secession are not the same. But he also says that the guys were good at the Hermitage, and they were knowledgeable, and they didn't try to shove down some type of narrative, shove a narrative down your throat. They were good, and then of course. The bookstore had some neat stuff in it, but of course the books are all pro Jackson. But he says, it's a good place to go. Go to the Hermitage and see where Andrew Jackson was from. It's a nice southern plantation home. It's a nice view, a window into the 1830s South, 1820s and 1830s South, which is an interesting time period in American history. And so in that way, you should go visit it. Again, I wish we would do more of this stuff, on tour it here, on tour it there. If anybody's listened to this podcast and you want to go on tour and you want to write about it and what you think about the interpretation of that historic site, send it our way. Go onto the website, go to article submissions at the top of the page, and shoot an email with an attached file about your southern excursion, being on tour somewhere, even in the north. One of my favorite stories was Tom DiLorenzo talking about how he went to Illinois and to the Springfield, and how the Lincoln Museum there, and it was hilarious when he tells the stories about the stuff he would see there and how he would laugh at it, and people would give him these looks, like these hushed tones, like, you are just doing the worst thing because you're laughing at St. Abe, and it was great. So little things like that are always worth a good laugh, and of course, a lot of fun to publish. So going out and go on tour and send these things to us, and we'll publish them. The last piece of the week, again, is an interpretation of a time period or a group of people that's completely alien to the reality of the group, and this would be the Radical Republicans. Again, if you look at Foner, the Radical Republicans are all the good guys, and you've got a narrative in the Republican Party today that these guys were the good guys. And I remember one time I was asked to go on a television show, and I thought I was going to talk about something, and I get there and I'm ambushed, and the whole panel, the whole point of it was to talk about the Radical Republicans and how great they were and how fantastic these people were for American society. And I was never asked back on the show again because I didn't just sit there and sing the praises of the Radical Republicans. But this is the narrative we get where you have a situation where the Republican Party is portrayed as the good guys and the Democrats as the bad guys. This is a piece by Alana Mercer, and she says there was actually a talking head, a GOP talking head, said this, quote, anybody who would trash Lee and laud Lincoln is either stupid as a post or just plain evil. I'm sorry. This is what Sage Reader said, but the talking heads. Excuse me, I read that wrong. A talking head said, "You can't have that. You can't say that. You can't say that Lee's good and Lincoln is bad. Because, I mean, this is going against the complete narrative. You can't say the radical Republicans are bad because, of course, these people are saints. This is the modern portrayal. But the radical Republicans considered Lincoln a moderate. They actually didn't even cry when he was assassinated. This is an opportunity for them. They did view it as an opportunity, but it was an opportunity for them to gain power. And they were the rump parliament. They were the Jacobins. They were the ones out there talking about extensive violence in the South. They were the ones creating the Union League, which was inflicting violence upon Southerners. They were the ones that were interested in property confiscation and other things. This is the stuff that Eric Foner says should have gone on. Violence. Hans Truffaut, in his wonderful book on Thad Stevens, points this out, in the radical Republicans, and how bad they actually were. And of course, Miss Mercer gets into the deeds of the radical Republicans in the South and how they were this violent kind of Antifa organization, even worse, though, because they had some power, and how bad this period actually was in the South, and how people like Andrew Johnson gets a bad rap, but Andrew Johnson was actually trying to have some form of reconciliation. Go, lo and behold, this, I mean, Johnson is the guy that's often excoriated and vilified, and this guy's terrible, one of the worst presidents in American history. Why? Because you have this Foner narrative of Reconstruction, when Johnson was actually a guy that's saying, look, we got to have some compassion towards Southerners, we got to do something here, we can't just have this unrestrained government, just this violence in the South, it can't go on. We got to have real reconciliation. But of course, that's not a narrative anybody wants to hear. They want to hear Southerners were all bad guys, and of course, radical Republicans were all good guys. Democrats are bad, Republicans good, etc., etc. It's a tired narrative. But this is what we've gotten because of the distortion of American history. And so, whether it's through popular media, whether it's through historic sites, whether it's through books, academic works, it's a distortion. It's flipping American history on its head, and this is what we're confronted with, and this is why the Abbeville Institute is so important, because we combat the narrative that the South is bad, the North is good, always, that the Southern tradition is just race and slavery. We combat that position, or that the Southern tradition doesn't have anything valuable to contribute to American society, and that that it's all just bad stuff. Well, if you do that, if you keep that narrative going, you're going to get Antifa. You're going to get the stuff, the radical, the violent left. This is what you're going to get. You're going to get the destruction of statues and all the things people are against. You're going to get all of that. This cultural war is created by this flipping of American history on its head. And so that is the point of everything that we do, to try to combat that, to try to show another side to this. Wait a second here. There's something to the South, there's something to the Southern tradition that's true and valuable, something that's worthy of holding on to, even if you don't think so. Until next time, good day.